Okay, meta memes are deep down systemic ideas without which a future is unthinkable.
Okay.
So secrecy is one of those things. If you say to yourself, okay, like if we're going to survive through the 21st century, then what sort of a political system do we need? You know, it can be Democrat, it can be Republican, it can be some Green Party or whatever. Is that really the game we have to play? Or do we have to look much deeper into our political system, identify what's wrong, deep down what's wrong with our political system? And one of those things is secrecy. Like why do we allow secrecy to continue on every level, on the local political level, all the way to the national level, all the way through to the international level? That there's secrecy everywhere, and this is holding us back. So let's dream of a political future where secrecy is taboo. So secrecy is taboo. Make secrecy taboo is a meta meme. It's a big idea that has the potential to change the whole ambience of the political game.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Serious episode. Not sad, though. Not like that 9/11 one. But serious episode for sure. If you want to hear that 9/11, it's First Responder. I forget what episode it is, but if you want to listen to something for the holiday, it is episode 235. But it's not about that today. It's about the revolution. When I was it was December of 2016. I had just finished recording my special, Double Negative. It's a double special. It's a two-part special. It's not two specials. It's a two-part special. If you haven't watched it yet, you should watch it. I would suggest starting with the second half, Adulthood. It's the funnier part. Children is also very good, but it's more thematic and admittedly not as many laughs. I should have started with that second one. I think it was something silly like a question of like, it's more like I was like, I think I had something like the beginning of the Adulthood, I was like, now in this hour, something like that. So that wouldn't have worked in the... Anyway, whatever. Who cares? But I was standing in line at Whole Foods. Whole Foods on 14th Street, Union Square. And a woman in front of me was reading a magazine. She turns, black lady, turned to me, about 27 years old. And yeah, that's right, you guys. Black people go to Whole Foods now. That's a real thing. That's a legit thing. You got to lay off that fucking stereotype that black people don't go to Whole Foods. You know what else they're doing a lot now? Mushrooms. It's finally infiltrated the black community. I don't know what it was. Black people never did mushrooms. I think it's psychedelics in general. Obviously, there's outliers, obviously. But somehow in the black community, oh, I did a joke about it once where I was like, all my black friends, like, why don't you do it? Like, too adventurous. I'm like, more adventurous than crack? Why don't black people do mushrooms? I think it had something to do with, honestly, like large percentages of our populations of black people who lived in, like, you know, urban ghettos, and there's just no fucking farms and cow patties there. But that can't be it. I did a bunch of mushrooms in L.A. You know, it's just a question of getting your dealer. But I don't know. Leslie Jones actually had a bit about it on SNL. I think it may be our first or second SNL she ever did. It was at the desk. And she said, black people don't do mushrooms. And the reason why is, she goes, because mushrooms make you call up some dark shit in your head. And black people, we got a lot of dark shit. But whatever reason, Kevin Iso, all these people are like... So, anyway, whatever. But congratulations, black people, for finally doing mushrooms. But that's not the story. This story is about the Whole Foods. And this lady turns to me. She looks me in the eye. I mean... gets my gaze. You know what I mean? And it's like, and she just goes, real serious. She goes, with a smile though, but she goes, read this. Read this. And she handed me a copy of this magazine called Adbusters. It was the November, December. It's a bi-monthly twice, which one's bi-month? It means every other month, whichever one that means is what I'm trying to say. I call it an art, anarchist art magazine. She handed this to me. And I was like, I mean, you can't turn down a fucking recommendation like that, you know? If you go to somebody, is there a good place to get pizza around here? And they go, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Go to this place. Go to Stromboli's or go to fucking Pizza Suprema. Be like, cool, got it. You know? You should do it. If they know offhand. Not like, let me think. I guess this one's okay. You know a good recommendation when you hear it. You know it. Or like you say, I'm going to a town, you know? Whatever it is. And they're like, oh, you're going to, like for me, if I say, if anybody tells me they're going to Indianapolis, I go, well, you got to go to Yats. And like, what's Yats? I'm like, it's just a Creole Cajun place, but it's, I love it. It's so good. It's not even expensive. It's a fucking $9 meal. Plus, if you don't have cash, they'll just let you slide. It's cash only. And if you're like, I don't have any cash, you're like, remember next time and pay us double. They're just cool people. That I went there once. I think I met Yat, but there's no way that's his real name. So you get a recognition like that, you're like, well, I should go. You know, this person cares better than a goddamn Yelp review. And this lady handed me a magazine and was like, read this. So I was like, yeah, I'm in for sure. There's no way I'm going to say no to that. There's just no way. I'm not a fool. By the way, best late night pizza in the East Village is Stromboli's on 8th, I think, and 1st. No, it's not next to the park. Yeah, 8th Street and 1st Avenue. It's open to like 4:30 too. It's not great, but it's good. And for late night, that's your option. You're not doing dollar pizza. Grow the fuck up. Anyway, so I read, I didn't even read it right away. So I just finished recording that album, special, I mean, editing it, got back to LA, got back to New York, and I was like going, packing, getting ready for this trip to Southeast Asia to fucking kind of disappear for a while. And I took it with me. There's a lot of creaking in this place. I took it with me first to Myanmar, didn't read it there. When did I start reading it? Thailand, I didn't think I read it there. And then I think I started reading it in Cambodia, on an island in Cambodia that I'm not going to mention. To protect it in my mind island. It was great. I'm also not going to tell you the best pizza place that I like because the lines are already long enough and I don't need them being longer. The place is doing fine business, but sometimes it's getting longer and longer. It's fucking great, but I will tell you Pizza Suprema if you're near Penn Station or Madison Square. Anyway, so on a fucking island in Cambodia, I finished reading this book about Aung San Suu Kyi. I started and finished Vagabonding by Rolf Potts. I just hung out with him last week. We got the Katz's Deli. And then I started reading this magazine. I finally opened it up. I was lugging it around country to country on my back. Fucking terrible idea. By the way, if you're going backpacking, minimize what you pack. I mean, seriously, if you're going to go hosteling around the globe, you want as little as possible. Your instinct is to be like, I want to make sure I have everything. Everything you have, that's weight on your back. I had two pairs of jeans through fucking 95-degree goddamn Southeast Asia. I abandoned them, one pair in Vietnam eventually. Nope, Phnom Penh. After Vietnam, came back, had one nice day at a hotel. I'm like, why am I still carrying around two pairs of jeans as it's getting hotter? I'm done with the mountains. And that was still, you only need the one. The point is this, build up. Don't build down, build up. Take like the underwear you'll for sure need, 6-7 pairs, and socks too, because you know, you'll have to wash those. And then it's like a few t-shirts and you'll get some. And you'll get toothpaste wherever you are. Build up. Anyway, why am I complaining about it? So I read this magazine and it's just a way of looking at the world that makes you reconsider about everything about power and about who's in control. It's great. I mentioned it to Nicholas Crapper. Crapper Flapper? Is it Crapper from Australia? Crapper. Yeah. He's great. He's going to open for me next time I'm in Australia, if he's there. I gave him, I was like, hey, do you want to read this magazine? I finished one because I became a subscriber. I finished one. I was like, hey, you want to read this? Because, oh, I still love Adbusters. I just stopped reading it. I didn't know. But a lot of people read it. Anyway, I'm reading this magazine, getting all these fucking revolutionary thoughts. I read this article. I'll read it to you in the outro. I think I've read it before. I was in a border town in Kupang, I think, Indonesia, headed towards Timor-Leste. I had to stop and get a visa. It was going to take a few days. Actually, I'll go into this in the outro. But the point is, I read this magazine. I kept it around and then eventually tore out this one article to take it home by John Dennehy. I'll read it in the outro. It's fucking great. But they talk a lot about revolution and not violent revolution. I mean like methods of overthrowing the powers that be and putting the power back in the hands of the people. To go from a top-down power structure to a bottom-up power structure. To limit the amount of advertising that's shoved into our brains. To embrace jazz and wild acts of art over regimented ways of being. In comedy terms, is to say that what Andy Kaufman did might not be for everybody, but to embrace the idea of something doing something wildly different. As opposed to a cookie cutter fucking, you know, dude comic who's like, it's funny, but it's like everything I've seen. You're just making this for everybody. To love nature. I don't know. It's values I shared. And I read these magazines over and over again. And they're a start to finish read. There's no ads in this episode of Skeptic Tank. Because Adbusters has no ads. That book is $15 to buy, that magazine. $15 for a magazine. I couldn't understand why until I realized later, there's no ads. They only work on subscription, and it is worth it. Each one's a book. It's not like a regular magazine where you read an article here or there. Each article builds on itself, and they're not really articles as much as like short stories and poems and essays. What was that group that takes... Billboard Liberation Front, where they take billboards and fucking change them to make something that looks completely different. Let me get a good example here. I know I had one. Nope. By the way, I'm going to be in... Brookout is already done. Madison, Wisconsin. At Comedy on State, September 19th through 21st, followed by Winnipeg at the Garrick Theater. One night only. Then I'm in Brea, California, September 26th through 28th. I think that's my last California running of Ari Shaffir Jew. So if you're in SoCal and you haven't seen it, come out to Brea. It should be good. Just added for the first week of October, then I'm done with my dates. San Antonio, Texas, I guess it's called LOL, October 2nd, followed by Dallas, October 3rd, Houston, October 4th and 5th. Dallas at the Addison Improv, Houston at the Improv. All tickets are available at arishafir.com. And then I'm going to go back to Dallas with my opener, Reggie Conquest, who is a Cowboy fan. And we're going to go to our first Cowboy game ever at fucking Cowboy Stadium. Not first Cowboy game ever anywhere, but first home game. Anyway, what am I saying? So... Oh, and then later on in October, I've got Nashville and then San Jose, Detroit in November and Cincinnati. And also the Vic Theater in Chicago, November 16th. That'll be the big one. Probably my last big, big show before my special. Anyway, back to it. So anyway, this instead of advertisement, this episode is brought to you by you guys. You the people. We the people. Adbusters magazine started Occupy Wall Street. They called for a day in order to protest these fucking corporate power structures, and they got it, and it turned into Occupy Wall Street. That's not a, oh, we're the place where Jerry Seinfeld started, which nine places say. No, it's for sure. Adbusters called for it, and it started. And their editor is this guy named Callie Lassen. And this is one of my favorite interviews because I tracked him down and I was able to get to him. And I said, I got to their first. Okay. So I found their number and I said, I don't know how I found it actually. Was it their number or that they're in Vancouver. But it's very American friendly and very Canadian friendly and very, really world friendly about governments and how to fight them. Corruption. And I tracked him down and I said, hey, I would like to do an interview with the editor-in-chief of Adbusters, Callie Lassen. And they were like, well, what's this about? And I was like, they said, interview him about what? And I said, the revolution. And they wrote back, oh, hold on a second. I wanted to hear what his version is of the revolution. Because I, from what I gather reading this anarchist art magazine, that's what I call it, his idea of the revolution is a different thing. He's more like the Arab Spring, where it's like he constantly says we have the power of this amazing thing in our hand, this phone that connects us all, that we can talk and we can overcome all these people. They can't hide this shit anymore. They can't hide laws and secrecy and back fucking room deals. That time is over if we all just talk. So I was like, well, I want to know how you feel the revolution is going to go. In either a good way or a bad way. Personally, Ari Shaffir feels I don't see any way around it other than violence. I think that's what it's going to turn to. I think when people get too frustrated with nobody doing anything for them, they're going to pick up arms and fucking fight. And I think that's the only way governments really listen. It's the only way any group of people give up power is if they're forced to. Very rare outliers, but generally that's the way it happens. Violent revolution. And I don't think Callie shares my thoughts. So we did this podcast. I will say, also in lieu of advertisement, you guys should sign up for Adbusters. I'm about to renew it right now. My fucking subscription came up. It's a one-year subscription. My first revolution. Oh, that's what I'll read in the outro. Here it is. Billboard Liberation Front. That's the thing. The next revolutionary issue, oh, they even say it, of Adbusters, number 147, the aesthetics of revolution and protest is currently being cobbled together amid rubble and ruin. We would like to remind you this will be your last issue. Don't miss out. Resubscribe today. Receive uninterrupted access. Adbusters, well, this is what they say right here, is a not-for-profit foundation. Our radical calls for reevaluation are made possible only with help from readers and rebels like you. We value your support. Save 15% at checkout with the discount code 1016. Didn't know about that when I started reading this out loud. To resubscribe, visit our culture shop. Speak with our staff by calling 1-604-736-9401 or send your mail to the address below. Oh, I get it. Adbusters Media Foundation. Damn. A digital subscription includes 6 issues delivered in high-res shareable PDF. 1 year of Adbusters digital for $25? That's it? Why do I pay the... No, because I like actual magazines. I would say, you guys, go ahead and get yourself a year. At very minimum digital, but I'd say get the full issue. It's so great to have in your hand, and this art looks so good. It's so good when you see a fucking Gucci ad with fucking blood drawn over the model's face or something. And so I asked if I could interview this guy, Callie Lassen, about the revolution, how he sees it going. And he said yes. So I was in Seattle for gigs. Didn't make my flight home until a day later. And I drove up to Vancouver, did some hiking, appreciated nature. That's what I think we should revolt for. I think I want like a new world order so I can actually enjoy nature. I can enjoy being outdoors and in the forest where I'm alone, where I really think clearly and have a good time. And so he brought me in and he was like, he didn't want to use the mic, so I'm telling you right now, it's ambient noise. It doesn't go up and down like the beginning of that bicycling podcast. That went up and down for like 3 minutes and then it got normal. So if you gave up in the first 3 minutes, fast forward 5 minutes in and you'll hear it. But we used the ambient mic, and we just talked about how he sees the revolution going. I will tell you this before we start. Adbusters is calling for Friday, September 13th, for 1 billion acts of civil disobedience. And I am going to join in. I'm going to read you this from, which issue is this? July, August 2019. A billion acts of, okay, on Friday, this is page, I don't know. There's no pages on here. This magazine's the best. On Friday, September 13th, let a billion acts of civil disobedience rain down on the current world order. Hashtag anything goes. A billion acts of civil disobedience. The moon will be full. The Friday the 13th hex will be in. And the kids will be walking out of class. Some of us will prowl around, slapping black spots on ads. I might be doing that. Others will place out-of-order signs on the world's ATMs. Oh, that's a good one. Many will solemnly vow to never set foot in a Starbucks again. Tame, you say? Don't be fooled. Making an independent coffee shop your personal headquarters is a strike at the heart of corporate hegemony. I don't know what that word means, to be honest. A viral act of defiance, a vote for authenticity, and a shot in the arm for local coffee culture worldwide. A few of us will go to the bank, withdraw all our money, and walk it over to the credit union or our community co-op. That's the first step on the road whose ultimate destination is a Robin Hood tax, the outlawing of flash trading, elimination of tax havens, and a total overhaul of the global financial system. Economics students will slap provocative posters up around their schools, nail manifestos to professors' doors. We are all calling for a paradigm shift in the science of economics. A few brave souls will bake a pie and connect it with the face of a lying politician. Or, better still, a fossil fuel exec. Zuck, too, is long overdue. And who deserves one more than the Orange Menace? The possibilities for individual actions are endless. The payoffs, momentous. So dig deep, comrades. On Friday, September 13th, let a billion acts of civil disobedience rain down on the current world order. If you want to find out more, visit abillionpeople.org. Ladies and gentlemen, I am ready for this goddamn revolution. And this magazine, along with fucking people like Billboard Liberation Front, but this magazine in particular, Adbusters, is paving the way, is mapping it out for everybody to how we get our fucking world back. Subscribe to Adbusters. Ladies and gentlemen, please enjoy this podcast episode I did with Callie Lassen. It's going to be one of my favorites of the year. Share this episode with your friends. Tell them about it. And then subscribe to that magazine. Get a year subscription. But do something. Disobey. Civil disobedience this coming Friday. Start thinking about it. Figure out a way. I wouldn't go violent. But you make your own decisions in life. I'm probably going to tag up a bunch of fucking advertisements. Dude, you should have seen when I was in Glastonbury, the complete lack of advertisements was so refreshing. They are shoving this shit into your eyes, into your mind, and they are forcing you to become a consumer above any sort of individuality you have. They want you buying shit. That's your only value to them. And I say we got to stop that shit. We got to show your value as your mind, as your creative energy, as shit like that. What do you have to add to the world? It's not how much you can fucking buy. What are your thoughts? What are your fucking new thoughts on a goddamn topic? Tell me about a place to go hiking. Ladies and gentlemen, Ari Shaffir, Skeptic Tank, episode 365, The Revolution with Callie Lassen starts now.
All right, I want to talk to few, because I've been reading Adbusters for a while, about a year and a half. I took one copy all over Southeast Asia, and I came then I handed it off to some Argentinians. As we're talking about this new way of thinking, like, I heard an artist say that people are actually picturing things in squares now instead of rectangles, because pictures have all become Instagram pictures, and the human mind is now altered to the point where we're picturing things differently. But what I really want to talk about is this revolution, the idea that, like, governments are never going to get back this power, and what are our options as citizens of the world in order to shift into a new way of a life, the way we can kind of handle and get behind.
Yeah, well, it's a very, very special moment, I think, in human history. Of course, we have climate change and we have financial instability, and things are looking kind of grim, and many people think that there's going to be that we're kind of spiraling into a possible 1,000 or 10,000 year dark age. You know, once the climate change really kicks in with a vengeance and so on. But at the same time, you know, there has never been a time in human history when we actually hold this revolutionary tool, this most revolutionary tool ever invented, in the palm of our hands, and we're just learning how to use it. And in some way, the possibilities are endless. So we could, as I said earlier, we could finish up with some sort of a Chinese type of social credit system that maintains total control over us, and descend into some sort of Orwellian or Huxleyan future that is horrible to think about. Yeah. But at the same time, we could finish up putting an end to this top-down power system that has ruled us for ever since the beginning of human history. Yeah. You know, it's always been top-down power. You know, whether it was the tribal leader, or whether it was the emperor, or whether it was whatever, it's always been top-down power. And we, the people, have always fought the top-down power, but the top-down power keeps on keeping on. And now, all of a sudden, for the first time in human history, we have this possibility of starting to call the shots from below.
So how would that work, just in terms of organizationally? You know, if there's eight of us here, and we're like, all right, let's build a deck, someone seems like someone has to, like, you be in charge of it.
Well, I mean, I think that's the task that lies ahead. Like many people, governments and China, you know, the Chinese programmers and so on, they have learned how to continue sort of projecting power from the top down. Mm-hmm. And corporations have also learned how to do that. Whereas we activists, even though the activists on the political right are sort of doing a better job than we on the left, I mean, there is some sort of a interesting stuff that's happening, you know. It's a projection of power from the bottom up. But we on the left have not learned yet. We're at the very, very early stages of learning how we can actually start pushing power up from the bottom up. At the moment, at Adbusters, we have this experiment. It's a website that we have, abillionpeople.org. Mm-hmm. And it may be the prototype of one of the ways to go, now that we all have this revolutionary tool in the palm of our hands. And the idea is that you get a vast number, as vast as possible number of people together, on an internet, on a website, and you start launching campaigns.
Such as what?
Well, for example, Extinction Rebellion is a perfect example of something that suddenly popped out of nowhere. They have a website. Suddenly they started doing some interesting things, creating controversy, blocking roads, gluing themselves to, I don't know, banks or whatever.
And I didn't see that one. What were they doing? Gluing themselves
actually,
to a bank?
Yeah, they actually have this sort of super glue, and people actually glue their hands onto, I don't know, onto a bus or onto a train or onto a bank window. And when the cops come, you can't actually take these people away very quickly and very easily.
Yeah, it's a new version of chaining yourself to a tree.
Exactly. They also do the chaining, where they chain people together and have 10 people chained together, and when the cops come, it takes them 2 hours to unchain everybody. So Extinction Rebellion is a perfect example of something that suddenly pops out of nowhere, captures the public imagination, and all of a sudden now it's taking off around the world. All of a sudden, there's 80 countries around the world that have these little Extinction Rebellion.
It seems like this stuff keeps popping up, kind of like a volcano when you don't release the tension or let the valve like open up. Like Occupy, even the Tea Party, and then Extinction Rebellion. It's just these like these dissatisfaction bubbles that are just like it's coming to a head.
Yeah, yeah, but there is a difference because we do have the internet. We do have these iPhones. We can talk to each other now. And you know, the Arab Spring, for example.
Occupy
Wall Street. I mean, yeah, this is basically without the internet, the Arab Spring would never have happened, and Occupy Wall Street would never have happened, mm-hmm. and Extinction Rebellion would never have happened. But I think that now we're sort of reaching a second stage of this. So instead of just having a like a shit bubble, where all of a sudden something just comes out of nowhere and creates a ruckus. All of a sudden, people are finding out that that's not enough because these things come and they go, and it's like a big bubble that gets everybody excited for a while, and then after a while, you know. How many roads can you block? How many hands can you glue to a bank window and so on? But now people are starting to talk about that if we really want to scare the existing power structure, if we really want to change the current world order in some significant way, then we have to sort of go deeper. We have to think about what here at Adbusters we've been calling meta-memes. You have to have a sort of a meta-memetic kind of a insurrection where we don't just sort of block a road and then tell our leaders, okay, well, we want you to stop climate change and then impose carbon taxes and so on.
Because they'll say no. They'll just like,
either they say no or they will decide themselves what they want to do, and it'll be just the same old top-down power game that's always existed with a little bit more input from us at the bottom. But it's not really changing anything fundamentally.
No.
But if you say to people, well, look, you know, we don't just want you to have carbon taxes, but we want you to change the political system. We want to have total transparency. We want us, the people, we demand to know everything from now on, and you can't do things in secret anymore. And secrecy has always been this game that the power people play. As long as they can keep things secret, start a war secretly or whatever, then they can always win.
And they always do it under the guise of, well, the population can't handle these truths. We need to do some stuff without telling them, but it's sort of ridiculous, right?
Yeah, so on the political front, I can imagine like a future world where we say we want the total elimination of secrecy. There's no reason whatsoever that we, the people, can't know everything, except for perhaps a few little secrets that have to do with national security. Maybe we'll give you that, but the rest of it is bullshit. You know, we won't put up with it. We will make secrecy taboo. Okay, and then on the...
So how would... Maybe I'm not understanding what meta-memes are.
Okay, meta-memes are deep-down systemic ideas without which a future is unthinkable.
Okay.
So secrecy is one of those things. If you say to yourself, okay, like if we're going to survive through the 21st century, then what sort of a political system do we need? You know, it can be Democrat, it can be Republican, it can be some Green Party, whatever. Is that really the game we have to play, or do we have to look much deeper into our political system, identify... what's wrong deep down? What's wrong with our political system? And one of those things is secrecy. Like why do we allow secrecy to continue on every level, on the local political level, all the way to the national level, all the way through to the international level? That there's secrecy everywhere, and this is holding us back. So let's dream of a political future where secrecy is taboo. Make secrecy taboo is a meta-meme. It's a big idea that has the potential to change the whole ambience of the political game.
So if you get that idea into people's heads where political secrecy is awful, it's taboo, and everyone starts to believe that, then it becomes unacceptable to have secrets?
Yeah, but what I'm really saying is that in addition to blocking roads and doing the things that we're already doing, let's also think about the meta-memes, because we're not going to, you know, we have to have sort of an ideological base, some big idea base, like what's our vision of the future? Yeah. What is our vision politically and ecologically, and what sort of internet do we want to have in the future? So we have to have big ideas on all half a dozen fronts of living in the 21st century, and I think in the political front, making secrecy taboo is one of those meta-memes. When it comes to the mental environment, when it comes to our internet systems and our communication systems, then maybe we have to sort of say to ourselves, well, is there a big idea there that can fundamentally change the way we think about communication? And I think there is an idea. The idea is that communication has always had a commercial edge to it. you know,
it's, say that again.
Communication has always had a commercial edge to it. You know, you watch TV, you have to take the ads. You know, you go to the internet, you have to give your privacy.
And we've accepted it.
And yeah, we were somehow always accepted. It said, okay, well, it's free and why not? Okay, so if they want to advertise to me, then I'll accept and so on. And yet, if you think about it very, very carefully, then you realize that maybe mixing communication with commercialism was some sort of a fundamental, systemic, stupid mistake that we made a long time ago. We've gotten used to it. But if we're going to have any kind of a real communication system of the future, then maybe we have to finally sever the cord. We have to sever this.
And why would advertising or why would communication and media like coming together be problematic?
Well, you know, because part of the reason why we have climate change now is because all of our communication systems are absolutely full of surveillance and advertising. Mm-hmm. So basically, yes, from the moment you grow up, you know, as a little baby crawling around the TV set in the living room, you're being told that, hey, if you consume, you're going to be happy. And, yeah. And so we've created a consumption system. We now consume 300% more than an average person consumed, you know, after the Second World War. So there's been a tripling. There's been a tripling of consumption by the average human being in North America over 50 years.
It does seem like there's a premium on like buy things, fill the hole that way.
Yeah. So if we want to stop climate change, then maybe we have to get back to the sort of consumption levels that we had, you know, 50 years ago. Maybe we need to sort of sever communication, commercialism and advertising and come up with a pure communication system, like a free net where all we do is talk to each other. All we do is communicate with each other without the interference of advertising and surveillance and all this other stuff, which is ultimately some sort of a mindfuck. So that's one of the really big ideas, and one way, another big meta meme, again in that sort of a mental environmental field, is the idea that okay, well, you can't immediately just say, all right, we want to have totally ad free communication system. I mean, that may take generations to actually create, but we can have maybe an ad tax, like okay, so if you want to. If you want to sort of show me an ad, you have to pay for it. And somehow the idea of eventually creating a pure communication system without commercialism intervening, and maybe one step along the way would be to popularize the idea of an ad tax. Like okay, so you want to give me an ad? Fine, then give me some money. Pay for it, yeah. And that, so in the... in the media arena, I think that the ad tax and severing that tie between commercialism and communication, I think those are deep down ideas that give people a vision of what our communication system of the future may look like.
Was the city that said kind of did away with advertising? Was it Berlin?
It was actually Sao Paulo in Brazil was the first one to do it.
And they said, no, you can have a storefront ad for your own store, and that's pretty much it?
Yeah, of course, they did it on a city level.
Yeah,
They're not doing it on the internet. They're not doing it on TV and radio and so on.
That's a start.
But it's a start. I mean, that's why I think what Sao Paulo did was fantastic, because it gets people thinking, yeah, why do we need cities that are full of billboards and bus ads?
You drive on Sunset Boulevard in L.A., and it's just hitting you from all sides.
I know.
Billboard. You can't just enjoy it and see the buildings anymore.
Yeah, and you go to New York and whatever. Oh, yeah. And it's just like, and we've sort of accepted it. So I think that we're living in an age now that we have climate change, and now that we have chronic financial instability, and now that we're in danger of spiraling into a long dark age if we don't deal with these two existential crises. Now I think we have to sort of stand back and say, what are the deep things that are wrong with our system? Mm-hmm. And I think that on the mental environmental level and on the political level, you know, there are all kinds of things. And when it comes to our marketplace, then I think there's another really powerful meta meme there that basically says, well, how come that we have this global marketplace and trillions of things are being bought and sold every day in our global marketplace, and yet the prices of all the products don't actually tell the ecological truth, you know. So for example, you go and you buy a car,
yeah,
okay, and it costs you $25,000. And then you hop in the car, and for the next 10 years, you're running around filling it up with gasoline, and you're pumping carbon into the atmosphere, and you're creating maybe $100,000 worth of damage to the planet, which future generations have to pay. So the true cost of a car, if you're really going to not just pay for the manufacture of the car and selling of it and all the rest of it that we pay now, but if on top of that you add on the damage that you do with that product, then all of a sudden, if you go on, if you have a what I call a true cost marketplace, then all of a sudden,
true cost, yeah,
a true cost marketplace where the price of every product tells the ecological truth. If you were able to segue from our current dysfunctional marketplace, which has got totally wrong prices for just about every product, and then you suddenly slowly, over the 10 years, work your way up to a marketplace that actually tells the truth with every product that's being sold, then that would be like using that Adam Smith power of the marketplace that could actually solve the climate problem. Because at the moment, you know, everything we buy doesn't tell the truth. We keep on buying more because it's so cheap.
And yeah, because all they have is money as the quantifiable amount of something. This amount of dollars, this amount of currency is the cost. But there's way more than that. You know, if you take a job in another town, the more cost is you're missing your family now. You know, they don't really put those in there. They just say, here's the money.
Yeah, but on a more fundamental level, if you buy a car and you pay $25,000, then who pays for the damage you cause?
Yeah.
Okay, so why don't you pay it? If you want to buy a car, then you pay for the damage. And that is a really powerful idea, this idea that the marketplace that we've had for a few centuries now, that seems to be working okay, and everybody believes in it. We all know that markets are one of the most powerful forces in the world, you know, how they organize societies. But why don't we segue from the current marketplace into a two-cost marketplace? And that idea of a two-cost marketplace, that's a meta-meme. That's a big, down, deep, you know, systemic change in our culture that is so big and so deep that if we were able to slowly move towards a two-cost marketplace, then this marketplace itself, by its inner dynamics, by the very process by which we buy things, it would start solving the climate change problem.
Because you would actually see the damage it's causing.
Not just see, but you would actually be, so all of a sudden, if you have to pay for the $100,000 damage that your car produces, then all of a sudden the car is costing you $125,000 instead of, and all of a sudden maybe less people will buy cars, and then we'll ask our governments to build you know, more railways and all kinds of other. So anyway, a two-cost marketplace, I think, is a really big idea, and I think that the job of economists in the future will be to actually calculate what the true cost of products should be. So
when I saw Arab Spring, and everyone was just inspired by it when it was going down, the people that I overthrew, their biggest problem was not shutting down the internet earlier. I can't imagine in America or Canada they wouldn't eventually just shut down the internet.
Explain that to me a little bit more. What do you mean?
Okay. People start meeting on the internet, saying, we got to meet up here, protests, whatever you want to do. Eventually, when you start taking back the power from whoever has it and saying, we want to like kind of rethink this government, no government gives back power on its own. I mean, maybe there's been a king over the history of the world that has, but like generally, it's you got to take it by force. Mm. And they know that our communication tool can just be shut like that.
Mm.
So why wouldn't they just shut it down?
Well, because I think they can't anymore. Back in the old days, maybe they were able to do it. But now, the Arab Spring, okay, it didn't quite work out. You know, all of a sudden, you know, we got rid of Mubarak, but now we have Sisi.
Yeah.
Sisi is actually even worse than Mubarak ever was.
Yeah.
But I think that we've reached a time now where people are getting really, they know how to, like, for example, what's happening in Sudan right now. What's happening in Algeria right now? All of a sudden, people are rising up and they're standing up to their governments and saying, "No, we."
South Korea,
yeah. So in a way, there are more and more examples of people power, somehow based on this iPhone in the palm of everybody's hand, and they've learned how to organize and how to put pressure back on the government and not to be squished down again by that top-down power. So I think the bottom-up power is growing. We're getting smarter and better, at the sort of tactical maneuvers that we're able to pull off with our demonstrations. And I think that the power balance, somewhere along the line, that power balance between top-down power and bottom-up power, I think we're at the early stages of it sort of tipping suddenly. Because if you, I mean, this current moment, actually, that we're living through right now is very interesting, because we have, when it comes to climate change, all of a sudden we have Extinction Rebellion that is coming out of nowhere and inspiring young people all around the world. And what they're saying is that the situation is so serious that we have to be prepared to get arrested and spend time in jail if we have to, but we have to pull off civil disobedience on a massive scale, and that is really the only way to solve this existential crisis of climate change. So that's happening right now, and it's inspiring everyone. Then the kids... High school kids are walking out of class every Friday in cities all around the world now. And all of a sudden, young people... And the young people are pointing the finger at our leaders, and then all saying, well, you know, you haven't done anything, you know, and we've only got 12 years to go, so if you can't do it, then we, the kids, will.
That's the crazy thing, too, with the internet, because before, 20 years ago, it was I'll make a recycle bin for my school. That's as far as it can go.
Yeah, yeah.
But now you can get stuff that really like transcends that and gets national, international.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a very kind of a hopeful moment. It's just a question of how far can we take it. I mean, will Extinction Rebellion just fizzle out like to some degree Occupy Wall Street did? Mm-hmm. Will the kids finally get tired of walking out of class every Friday, and will that whole thing fizzle as well? Or will other things start to happen and whatever, and all of a sudden enough people around the world are so angry at our leaders and our current sort of ecological policies that all of a sudden we scare the shit out of those leaders just by our ability to mobilize huge numbers of people who are willing to get arrested and pull off huge demonstrations and protests. So in a way, the balance can tip.
So, but in Occupy, one of the ways that kind of the government and corporations fought back was to put sort of undercover fake homeless people mm-hmm. in with them, have them start fights, and then the police could come in and use power to like break it up. There's fights
mm-hmm.
now. Mm-hmm. I keep saying that eventually they're going to do that. I would love to imagine a world where the revolution could happen peacefully.
Well, to some degree, I think you're caught in the old mentality. We've had thousands of years of top-down power, and somehow you don't seem to be able to imagine a system where all of a sudden we, the people, rise up with a revolutionary tools in the palm of our hand and actually all of a sudden tip the balance in some way that is really significant. I think that we're at the early stages now of seeing that happen. But I think that... That we have to, there's other things we have to learn. I mean, it's not enough just to sort of block roads, and we have to go into that meta meme direction. We have to have behind everything we do, there have to be these big ideas, these meta memes, and I think we have to sort of eventually come up with a sort of what I call a meta memetic insurrection, where we're pushing not just pushing for immediate change on climate change, but we're trying to change all the deep down. We're trying to change the deep state, if you like. We're trying to change the deep hidden assumptions of our current world order.
Where I need this, I have to have this.
Yeah, so. I want politics to be without secrecy. You know, I want a marketplace that tells the truth. You know, and I want to have a communication system that. That is not interrupted by ads every few minutes. So those sort of
business
changes are important.
Politics is a big one.
The other thing that is necessary is that at the moment there's a lot of stuff happening on a national level, but we don't have enough global Big Bang moments. So, for example, on September the 13th, that's coming up in a few months' time, we're sort of calling for a global Big Bang moment. You know, where we're saying, hey, this is a... It's Friday the 13th, and we've got this sort of a strange hex that the number 13 always has to do with, you know, it also happens to be a Friday, and the kids can walk out of school on that day. No. It also happens to be a full moon day.
Oh, nice.
It's a full moon, so maybe the wolf packs will come out and start howling at the moon. And so we're trying to sort of say, all right, after we've done next, you know, glued ourselves to banks in London and done all this stuff in cities around the world, walking out on Fridays, maybe we can also have some sort of this global Big Bang moment where where we it's so huge and so big, and so many millions of people are involved on this one day, creating mayhem and demanding a move away from business as usual, that we sort of scare the shit out of our leaders. It all of a sudden it becomes like 10 times bigger than the protest we had, you know, 20 years ago against the Iraq war, for example. All of a sudden we start operating on a global level and demanding systemic change on a global level, and I can imagine that happening. I can imagine.
And you can imagine a government going, yes, okay, I'll stop taking kickbacks. Like, there's an individual and there's also a government. All I know really is about American politics. But it seems they're so similar. If you ever want to communicate with somebody in another country, I found just shit on your own government, and they'll be like, yeah, we got that too. And then everyone's friends.
Yeah, but when you get a huge number of people, you know, getting
like
together and doing
people.
Stuff, you know, then they start doing some crazy stuff, you know, because, you know, all of a sudden we find out, you know, like on September the 13th, on that Friday, you know, maybe Mark Zuckerberg will get a pie thrown in his face.
Right.
Maybe there's going to be sort of a demonstration in front of the Fed, you know, by 1,000 people who demand different kinds of financial policies and telling the Fed that we want to have a stop to do flash trading and all kinds of systemic changes to the way that money flows around the planet. And so crazy shit can happen, you know, when vast numbers of people get angry, like they have got now angry with Extinction Rebellion. Crazy shit happens, and crazy shit scares leaders. You know, the crazy shit happened in Egypt, and Mubarak was gone. Okay, so we got Sisi, we didn't quite succeed. But nonetheless, it proved that, you know, you can depose systems, you can get rid of tyrants if enough people believe.
And you can keep deposing tyrants until you get someone who's like, all right, this is good. We like this now, where we're at.
You know, not only that, but you can not only get somebody you want, but while you're getting somebody you want, you're also setting out an agenda for
system.
What you want. You're going to say, we want this, we want this, we want this. And eventually, you know, you'll get some leader that says, all right, I'll give it to you, you know. And then, you know, it's... I mean, you can have a kind of Obama-like moment. I remember when Obama first came on and I listened to his first speeches and he totally blew me away with his eloquence. I can imagine down the road there'll be other Obamas, but this time they won't be sort of weak-kneed like Obama was, but they will be people who say, yes, I'm going to give you a two-cost marketplace. Yes, I'm going to give you a political system that's way less secret than it is now. And yes, I'm going to give you a communication system that, you know, that doesn't have too much commercial interference.
Because when you think about it, that's just self-serving. If enough people want that, then I'll be the leader who gives that to you, then I'll be a leader. You know? If everybody wants this one legal weed, let's say, and I'm the only one, you guys got that guy, and then you have someone who's like, I'll give that to you, then I'm like, shh, then you're in. We like that. Go.
Sure. Yeah. And also, I think that, you know, again, the old system used to be, okay, there's one big leader up top and everything depends on him, like Trump right now. He's just calling the shots on all fronts and all we're doing is just trying to keep up with him. And you know, okay, you can imagine an Obama-type leader down the road who's giving us everything we want. But maybe even that system is going to be superseded by some system that's a little bit more bottoms up. At the moment, we vote for somebody. We say, okay, you know, Trump is the leader, or Biden will be the next leader, or whatever happens. And we'll leave it up to them, and they'll fix things. Or maybe we'll say, no, we want to do more than vote. You know, we want to actually have daily input into our systems. You know, we want to send petitions. We want to come up with ideas. We want to have referendums. We want to get truly involved in our democratic process, and we want to demand all these metamimetic changes. And we want to, you know, so in a way there's a I can imagine a democracy that is way more participatory on a daily, weekly, monthly basis than the system we have now.
And who's getting in the way of that? What groups or what people or what corporations are saying, nah, don't go that way?
Well, I don't think there's too many corporations, whatever. I think they, of course, they prefer the status quo. They want to have business as usual, and there's a huge sort of momentum, I guess, to keep the business as usual world going and the current world order going the way it is. But I think the big limiting factor right now is in us, the people, not having the boldness to actually imagine a different kind of a future, and for politicians to, you know, like you come up with these 21 democratic presidential hopefuls, and what the fuck? I mean, they're all saying roughly the same thing.
Most of them are.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a little bit different here, a little bit different there, but basically, it's just business as usual.
Stay at war.
Yeah, it's my friend, same old bullshit.
Serious libertarian, and he says, like, when they're like, yeah, but you're more Democrat than Republican, right? He goes, no. One group says, I want to take 37% of your money and do with it what I want. The other group says, I want to take 34% of your money to do with it what they
want.
Right,
big deal.
It's the same shit either way.
Exactly.
None of them are really saying the things we want to hear.
Yeah. So the biggest limiting factor is that we don't know our own power. Now, in this internet age, with this revolutionary tool in the palm of everybody's hand, we actually have the tools we need now to create a bottoms-up democratic system where we, the people, start calling the shots and most often getting what we want.
Yeah.
And it's our lack of revolutionary fervor. It's our, you know, we're still weighed down by thousands of years of top-down rule, and nobody quite believes that we can actually take charge.
Yeah, no one really believes that because you weren't raised with it. I was actually in China when they were announcing during the NSA scandals we had in America, and China was saying right before that that they're going to put bugs in everyone's computer that they sell. They announced it publicly because people have no power. People lost their minds. So like, don't do that. We want to be on porn. We want to be on something about revolutionary stuff. Mm-hmm. We want some secrecy. And the government said, okay, we didn't realize all you guys were against this. So we won't do it. And at the same time, Obama was just doing that in America and keeping it quiet.
Yeah. That power of secrecy was so clearly revealed, you know, when Snowden sort of revealed what was happening there. The fact that we were being surveilled on that level without even knowing it. I mean, I can't believe that there wasn't sort of a second or a third American Revolution right there.
Right there. And then the people
took it, right? They took it.
And he wasn't propped up as a hero. Instead, a lot of people were like, traitor. Get him out of here. Let's put him in a hole forever. And it's like, really?
Yeah.
How do you point out this great flaw in the system?
Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of incredible flaws in the system right now. I can't believe that in America you have a president, you know, that doesn't believe in climate change.
Yeah.
And nobody really holds his feet to the fire on it. It's almost as if here's an idiot who doesn't believe in climate change, even though it's happening right before his nose. And somehow he has work himself into a position where nobody's even challenging him on it anymore. What the hell is going on with the American people? Why can't the American people say, you know, that we somehow expose the absolute imbecility of having the leader of a country, the most powerful country in the world, who doesn't believe in climate change, and somehow the people don't have the wherewithal or the power to sort of somehow stop him from being such an idiot. I mean, I
think people are distracted. I think they each have their own issue, and they've been told that this should be their issue, whatever it is. And then they're like, all right, I can't worry about climate change. I'm worrying about Mexicans with guns coming over the border, or whatever they've been told to believe. When you talk about this powerful tool we have, which is, I believe, you're right, the phone now, we're so connected. But that comes with things like Facebook. I know you hate Facebook. I mean, it's so obvious from Adbusters, and I agree with you. That comes with these distractions to keep us stopping us from using it as a revolutionary tool, putting us in line, keeping us as sheep.
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, Facebook was instrumental in launching the Arab Spring to some degree.
Uh-huh.
So in a way, I mean, but what we of course need is alternative systems. We need a Facebook of activism that doesn't surveillance you. You know, we need to sort of come up with alternative communications platforms like Facebook, but not Facebook. You know, we don't. So in a way, I think we sort of allowed the Facebooks and the Amazons and the Googles to sort of shocked the hell out of us with the incredible power of this digital revolution that was washing over us, and we allowed them to sort of run away with the ball and become this troika of three powerful internet mega corporations that are sort of controlling everything now. And now we have to dismantle that troika.
And okay, yeah, I agree with that. How do you stop a corporation? Because it seems to me they're just organisms who feed on money or whatever to grow, and they don't know who they're swallowing up or what.
Mm.
How do you stop? How do you keep a corporation acting like Ben and Jerry's?
Well, okay.
And not like...
So here's the other metamim that I haven't talked about yet, and this is the metamim to do with corporations.
Okay.
So the fundamental fact about corporations is that they exist only because we, the people, give them a corporate charter. So before a corporation can can come alive and start doing business in our society, mm-hmm. they have to go to the attorney general of one of the states. In America, it's usually Delaware for some reason, because they have very nice laws there for corporations.
Oh, yeah.
and the corporations say, okay, we're going to start a corporation, it's called Google, and or it's called Exxon or whatever, and they have to put it all down on a piece of paper, and then it has to be approved by the attorney general, who acts on behalf of the people. And then once that they have this legal charter, once the charter has been given to them, then they can go ahead and start doing business. Now, one way to, I mean, you can sort of get angry at corporations and shout at them and boycott them and do everything that we've been doing for the last, but they will still last forever. They will still doing. Eventually, they will win. They will outlast us. But we, the people, actually have control over that legal personhood that we give to corporations through the charter. And if we started saying, all right, from now on, if a corporation wants to have a charter, then we're going to put in the charter certain conditions that this corporation has to live up to. And we're going to put in penalty clauses. If they break the law three times in a row, then we're going to remove their charter. We're
death penalty.
Death penalty. They are taking away a charter of a corporation, revoking its charter is the equivalent of a death penalty for a corporation. But also you can have bi-yearly or every 5 years, you can say, okay, every 5 years, Google or Exxon or whoever it is, we're going to review our charter. We're going to sort of get all the people together and say, well, how well is Exxon doing? You know,
would we now still give them a charter?
Yeah, and does that charter have to be changed a little bit now? Like, do we have to say to Exxon that from now on you can't keep on funding, you know, climate denial groups? And what you've been doing there, or we don't like your PR strategy, you're lying to the people, so for the next 5 years you're not allowed to advertise, or for basically for us the people to say, look, these corporate charters are privileges that we legal privileges that we give to corporations, and we have to take more control over that whole process of who we give a corporate charter to and what are the conditions under which that charter can keep on going.
If you look at British Petroleum, BP, their giant oil spill in the Gulf, it was worth it in the end with the amount of money they paid in fines to not be up to standard code. They made more money not being up to the code and paying the fines than they would have just being up to code. So you really, it's a slap on the wrist that they're like, we would do the same way again.
Yeah. I mean, usually when corporations do something really bad, it's quite often just the cost of doing business, you know, mm-hmm. and everybody knows that. But somehow, until we go back to the corporate charter, until we, the people, take control of all the corporate charters that we, all these privileges and these rights to exist and so on that we give corporations, as soon as we take control of that process and monitor that process and tweak it every now and again or change it every now and again, so like basically that. Make it quite plain to every corporation that you exist because we, the people, have given you the right to exist through your corporate charter.
Yes.
And you'd better fucking listen to us from now on. Otherwise, we're going to yank your charter and you will cease to exist.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of deep down sort of new way of thinking about corporations that we need if we're going to to get rid of this power imbalance between people and corporations. At the moment, the corporations are totally in control. We, the people, are almost totally subservient, and we don't seem to know how to do it. Well, the way to do it is through the corporate charter.
I like that. They had, not to keep bragging about China, but the only thing I like about China is they're not hypocrites. They're not telling you one thing, they're doing another. They're saying you have no power. But there was this baby formula corporation, and they all tested to see how pure it was so they can put that on their label. And this one corporation put in additives to make it test better. And it killed 12 babies. And they didn't find them. They found the CEOs that did it, and they hung them all. They said, you can't just kill babies and get away with it. We're not fucking with your corporation. You killed a child. You're done.
Yeah.
And I think we need a little more of that here, where it's like you can't hide behind your charter.
Yes, I think the idea behind all those meta memes is I guess to try to encapsulate it all in one way, it requires a certain sort of level of boldness and maybe audacity. It's almost like do we, the people, actually, are we audacious enough to demand that we have some control over corporate charters?
Yes.
Do we, the people, have enough say over our political system that we can get rid of most of secrecy? Do we, the people, have enough control over our own communication system so we can reduce the commercial and the surveillance influence in our communications? So in a way, do we, the people, have what it takes to think big about the future?
And say we have the power. What happens if we do nothing?
Well, then we're going to spiral into a 10,000-year dark age.
What do you mean? Loss of power, loss of
no,
fuels.
No. I think that if we don't have some sort of a metamimetic revolution, if we don't sort of completely change the business as usual world we live in, and if climate change, which is already hitting us with a vengeance, and it's only getting worse, we only have 12 years left. If we can't fix things in the next 12 years, you know, then climate change. The temperature of the planet will get so hot, life will become so unbearable, people will be fighting over water, they will be fighting over food, World War III will probably erupt, and people will be brutally fighting each other for last little scrap of trees and water and minerals and all the rest of it. This human experiment of ours on planet Earth will break down, it'll become total chaos, there'll be some sort of a die-off, and we will be entering a very, very long dark age that could last for hundreds of years or maybe thousands of years.
Yeah. There was one issue you guys did where it really broke down, like first the revolution and then suddenly no government, then warlords. And like, oh yeah, that would happen.
It's back to warlords,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, and then the warlords would be overthrown, and then it's like, and then we're all about, like, nature is our, oh, man, it was so, like...
I think it's highly possible that if we don't fix everything in the next... if we don't fix the current world order in a fundamental way, then I think we are going to go back to an era of, you know, the global system will break down, national systems will break down, and we'll be back to a warlord.
Villages,
warlords, there'll be tribes fighting each other for the, you know, access to this river of water or whatever. And and so, yeah, I think there's a real possibility that this experiment of us on this human experiment of ours on planet Earth will just basically break down and crash and burn, and we'll have to sort of work our way up again for the hundreds of years, you know, and get back to roughly where we are now, perhaps.
I mean, that's most plagues. That's what happens.
Yeah. It
drops down the population. They slowly build up again.
Yeah.
Fresher and cleaner. Mm-hmm. You talked a little about, what do you mean? I always talk about Adbusters being an anarchist art magazine. I don't really know if that's how you put it, but it seems like advertising is, in your book, always wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. Is there a way for it to be non-problematic?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, it was non-problematic. There were ads, you know, in newspapers, there were ads in magazines. And when TV came along, when I was a teenager, then all of a sudden a few ads started popping up on TV, and that felt fine. But then somehow we allowed it to get out of control. All of a sudden, the advertisers turned television into a mass merchandising tool. You know,
everything exists on television so they can sell burgers and cars.
Yeah,
that's the only reason any sitcom exists.
Yeah, and suddenly we were ambushed every 10 minutes by another 3 or 4 or 5 minutes of ads, and all of a sudden TV became this big sort of commercial slugfest, and so. I don't have anything fundamental wrong about advertising. I think that if you have a product and you want to let people know about it, then I think it's great that you let them know that actually you're cheaper than some other guy or whatever. I have no problem with advertising. I have no fundamental problem with advertising. But I just don't like it when they're advertising the $1 trillion a year advertising worldwide industry worldwide. When it gets to the point where it's dictating the sort of television we have, where it's dictating the sort of internet we have, where it's dictating the sort of magazines we have, when it becomes so powerful that it just takes over and works its way into every nook and cranny of our lives in a way that a human being or a young person growing up in that society can't help but be totally hijacked, you know, his personality and his beliefs and the way he thinks about climate change and the way he thinks about corporations and the way he thinks about everything, that somehow to have that person completely molded by this commercial power structure that advertising has created.
My friend hosted a television show, a stand-up comedy show. It was right after the first Gulf War, right afterwards, or maybe the second one.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was like 2001-ish. And they told him no jokes about the Iraq War, was not allowing it. But it wasn't a governmental thing. It was an advertising thing. It was, we're going to piss off McDonald's and whoever else.
Mm-hmm.
So it was weird because then it started to inform the actual art form. Instead of like, maybe he wasn't going to do anything about it, then no harm, no foul.
Yeah.
But if he was, then suddenly it's like, this shouldn't be the reason.
Yeah.
I should only do it or not do it because it's not funny.
Yeah.
Not because someone else is telling me.
Yeah. Well, you know, Adbusters was created 30 years ago when we tried to buy airtime for a 30-second TV spot.
Yeah.
That spoke back against the forest industry in the Pacific Northwest. And we found that the television stations were absolutely happy to take the million-plus dollars that the forest industry had, telling everybody that they're doing a fantastic job in our forest and we've got forests forever was their slogan, I remember. And when we came up with our 30-second spot and tried to go head-on-head with the forest industry, the television stations said to us, oh, sorry, you know, your ad isn't really an ad. It's sort of something else, and we can't really sell you any airtime. And besides, your budget is only $5,000, so it's very tiny compared to what the forest industry is willing to spend. And so all of a sudden, you know, we found out that at that time, you know, 30 years ago, television was the most powerful social communications medium of our time.
Mm-hmm.
And what the hell? A citizen didn't have the right to walk into a TV station and put his money on the table and buy 30 seconds of airtime for a dissenting message of some kind. And it reminded me of my own country. I was born in Estonia. And in my country for 50 years, you know, you weren't allowed to speak back against the government.
At all.
At all, no. And if you did speak back against the government, then there was a horrendous price to pay. You had to, you were deemed to be sort of mentally disjointed, and you weren't able to get a job as a civil servant, and you couldn't find a good job anywhere, and you were marginalized, and your life, you know, is just fit. You know, basically, you couldn't really live a halfway decent life in Estonia during the Soviet occupation of our country. And then, you know, 34 years later, I find myself in North America, you know, the land of the free and the home of the brave. And here, I'm not allowed to buy airtime on a TV station.
They wouldn't let, for the Super Bowl, they wouldn't let, it's the biggest television event in the world.
Yeah.
They wouldn't let a marijuana company buy at the standard rates. They're like, no.
Well, why do we, the people, put up with that? I mean, this is our mental environment. These are our public airwaves. You know, we should have total freedom there. And when the Super Bowl or when any TV station says, "Oh, sorry, you can't speak back against Exxon, or you can't speak back against the fashion industry, or you can't speak back against fast food, or you can't speak back against marijuana," then, and for us to take that, for us to be told, "No, you don't have freedom of speech, and you know, just go away and just leave us alone." I don't know why we the people take that. You know, we need a communication system that's a total open book. It has to be a free for all, where everybody's allowed on to say whatever they want to say. And
why not? And obviously, parental controls. You're not going to put a marijuana commercial on. You know, Pokemon.
Yeah, but that's
with a little common sense, you can still be able to.
We need. Of course, you always need common sense, but you
there's
can't.
No anti-war ads. There's nothing about bring soldiers home. Mm. What are we doing anywhere?
Yeah, so secrecy in politics is one thing, but censorship in the media is another. Like censorship, there should be no top-down censorship. There should be nobody that says that you can't buy airtime on a TV station or you can't air a certain kind of a message, and only with that kind of a totally free marketplace of ideas, only that kind of a communication system can save us.
And how do you stop that? By the way, any question you have about how to install a new government does not negate, you know, the quality of that government, that idea. But how do you install that without? Because people are kind of idiots sometimes. So how do you not let sort of just idiocy take over, you know, and say we want, I don't know, whatever it is. Like in South Africa, Mandela was a great leader.
Mm-hmm.
They elected him. When he was gone, then it's this uneducated voting base that elected a Zulu warrior with 10 wives who thought he'd have sex your AIDS away.
Yeah, well, we human beings are, you know, flawed in all kinds of ways. And we make stupid mistakes and so on. But I do believe that like Martin Luther King said, you know, that that somehow justice does bend in a sort of a benign direction. So I think that if we were able to create a different kind of a mental environment, if we were able to sort of create a different kind of a politics, we have a different kind of a marketplace. If we make these fundamental changes and basically change the very ambience, the very nature, the style, the feeling of living in this system that is fundamentally different from the current one we have now, then I think that we can bumble into the future with some assurance that we're not going to totally blow it.
Yeah, when you talk about 12 years, you talk about the report said that's where you got left everything goes.
Yeah, I think it's even more serious than that. I mean, they keep on saying 12 years and then another 12 years, whatever. But I think that, like, every day I mean, when I turn on the, you know, I look at the evening news. I like to see what the ABC, NBC and CBS News says every evening. Like, every night there's another storm, another flood, another fire. There's something happening almost daily. It's very unusual to have one day when some catastrophic climate event hasn't already happened. So I have a feeling that, you know, that the oceans are already pretty acidy. The permafrost in the poles is already melting. The temperature is already getting so high that the asphalt is melting in hot places like India, where the temperature goes up to over, what is it, like 47 degrees last summer?
What?
Something like that. It was like,
what?
It's so hot that people can't go outside anymore. It's getting so hot in some places that people can't actually go out anymore. And I mean, your body cannot tolerate 47 degree temperatures,
no.
Right? So
we don't know. 35 is like 100. So
yeah, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about the 47. Maybe it was just 37. I'm not sure there. but anyway, it's this avalanche, this tsunami of bad climate events is happening so hard and fast now that I doubt whether we even have 12 years. So I'm betting on stuff like Extinction Rebellion, where all of a sudden we the people say, all right, we enough talk now, enough debate now. Now we're going to go and basically engage in civil disobedience on a massive scale, and we're going to force our leaders to do our bidding.
Yeah, in terms of the metamines, I think AdBuzz is actually really great at getting ideas, like not just on the top of your brain, but in there. Hold on. This Facebook is fucking up.
I think though that idea that this idea of meta memes, I think it's really important because, you know, without some sort of a game plan, without sort of a large vision of what the future could look like, then ultimately you're just sort of pissing around in the backwater, so to speak. You're just not really going to get the job done if you can't get beyond blocking roads and gluing yourself to things. So I think you do need we need those. We have to figure out what are the big ideas without which a future is unthinkable, and we have to zero in and have to have this sort of global brainstorm about what are those half a dozen ideas that we need to change. And I think that
non-negotiables.
Yeah, they're almost like non-negotiables. We need to this kind of a communication system. We need this kind of a marketplace. We need this kind of a political system. And if we don't have that, then we're not going to be able to pull ourselves out of this this sort of apocalyptic existential crisis moment that we find ourselves in right now.
Yeah, they shut down everything that's anti-war. They shut it. They shut down even the thoughts. The political candidates who speak about leaving war, they're just like they get less coverage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially with in America right now. I mean, when climate change and financial instability and 1% grabbing most of the money, mm-hmm. when you start putting that kind of pain on ordinary people, then the suffering gets so great. And I think that in the heartland of America, it did get so great that people were willing to elect a sort of a guy like Trump, who has unmistakable fascist tendencies to him. And that's happened not just in America now, but it's happened in many other countries around the world. The populist right is in ascendancy. And as the situation gets worse and worse and worse, then more and more these fascist-type leaders are going to take over and promise to get us out of the fix we're in. And that is how the Third World War will begin. And that is how our long spiral into a long dark age will begin.
I have this theory that Occupy Wall Street was almost identical to the Tea Party movement, which it was just citizens not thinking their government represents them anymore, and they're just angry enough to protest.
Yeah, we were not. No, I mean, Occupy Wall Street was a sort of a global Big Bang moment. It was wonderful while it lasted. It was never intended to be like the Tea Party. The Tea Party, right off the bat, I mean, they basically started electing people and they wanted to use the existing power system and start to playing the power game that exists and change it, have whatever they want to change that way. Whereas Occupy Wall Street was a much deeper kind of a thing. It was basically a movement that said things are fundamentally wrong with the world. You know, we can't allow the 1% to run away with the ball. We need to talk about all kinds of stuff, and we need a fundamental sort of a rejig of the whole system. And I think it politicized the whole generation of activists around the world. I think it did a lot of good. I don't agree with those people who say it fizzled out. It was never meant to live forever.
Right.
It was just supposed to be one revolutionary step along the way.
Didn't they want eventually, I mean, especially Zuccomati Park, where it's sort of base-based, but didn't they want eventually, as an idea, for the guy in charge of business to come out and say, okay, I'll do what you say. And since that never happened, I think that's why people were saying it didn't get what it was trying to get.
Mm. Yeah, but, you know, people always say, well, they're not sure, they Occupy Wall Street, they didn't know what they wanted, and we knew what we wanted. We wanted fundamental change, and we had a lot of debate about what that could be, but we were a step along the way, and we politicized the whole generation. And I think that Bernie Sanders is a child of Occupy Wall Street to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Extinction Rebellion and a lot of other things that are happening right now, the same people that were in Occupy Wall Street, you know, 8 years ago, are the same people now who are learning more and more how to use that revolutionary tool in the palm of their hands and start changing the world in different ways. So for me, Occupy Wall Street was a one step along the revolutionary path. And I never saw it as in the Tea Party terms.
And so with its lasting ability to me is that people now are like, oh, hey, there's problems with corporations. That meta meme is now in people's heads.
Yes.
You know, where it's like, I don't know what to do about it, but at least I know there's a problem now.
Yeah.
I was on an anonymous march through New York.
Oh, yeah.
And it was fun. It was interesting. But I kept seeing the people in the mask just screaming at people in cafes, you know, wake up, sheeple. But I'm like, guys, they don't know what you're talking about. You're just a guy in a mask screaming at them. Like, better ways of getting the word out. The problem is media is trying to push down the ability of you to do that. So you're on this thing that's at once a freeing device, but also it has engineers working to addict you to the wrong parts of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a lot wrong with our current system. Business as usual has a huge, you know, multi-thousand-year momentum behind it. Top-down power is still omnipotent, and the job of activists of the future, mm-hmm. some of who are children of Occupy Wall Street and children of the Extinction Rebellion, it's up to us to figure out, you know, what sort of a world we want to live in the 21st century.
Can I ask? Listen,
I've got some others. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's been great talking to you.
Yeah. So if you have one final question, that's fine. But.
I was going to ask about the Bill of Liberation Fund, but what are you fighting for? I just want, because everyone talks about changing it and what they want, but like, what's this, to me, I'm fighting for the ability to take a walk in a park and not be, you know, just enjoy nature. Like, what are you fighting for?
Well, I'm fighting for a system that I can believe in wholeheartedly. I'm fighting for a system where I feel I have a certain crucial level of control over what happens. I want to live in a future where I, together with millions of other people, can steer my country and the fate of humanity into some direction that computes.
Yeah. Man, it's great meeting you.
Okay.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice talking. Is amazing.
Yeah, you know how to ask it. You know how to get me riled up with your questions.
Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction. Sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah. We'll be right back.
that is the episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm in awe of this dude. When I went to the fucking offices of Adbusters and realized they are throwing this thing together with just like five people. Callie is the editor, but he's an artist, man. He's culling this stuff and making commentary on it while he's bringing it in. It's like if you look at a page and there's an essay, look at the page before and the page after because it's a commentary on that page. And the page before that is a commentary on the next page. It's great. It's great. And these guys are putting it together on a fucking shoestring every week. Subscribe and disobey this Friday. A billion acts of civil disobedience. What are you going to do? What are your friends going to do? Make it happen. Figure out something small if you can't figure out something large. Do something because putting your mind to it is fucking, you're halfway out of the game. And now you're fucking free. So I want to read you this article that I read. I was talking to these Argentinians in Coupang. I was waiting by the way, don't forget, I'll be in, this month, I'll be in Madison, Wisconsin, the 19th through the 21st. With my daughter, Jessica Michelle Singleton, will be hosting, and Adrian Appalucci, who's just right now recording this week in Las Vegas. If you're there, for sure check her out. Her Degenerates, 15 minutes Degenerate thing for Netflix. Fucking for sure go. And when you see her, she's so dark. So if you're going to go to that taping, she's not serious. So you got to laugh. And that'll make the other people who don't know what a fucking... Why a comedian would say something so serious, doesn't do the math and be like, oh, because they're joking. They get weird, start laughing, and then everyone else start laughing. She's great, and she's about to blow up, and you guys will say you saw the thing that helped her blow up in Las Vegas. Go to Aya Palucci or whatever. I'll tweet about it where her taping is or how to get a ticket. Go to Robert Kelly. He's there too. Norton's on the show. Miss Pat's on the show. Go to any of their things and you can get a ticket, a free ticket, I'm pretty sure. So Madison, Wisconsin, the 19th through the 21st at Comedy on State. Garrick Theater in Winnipeg on the 22nd. And then Brea, California, my last Southern California gigs, September 26th through the 28th. I'll also be in San Jose the second weekend of November, 7th, 8th, and 9th. And that'll be it for California. So if you're in that state and want to come see me, those are the only two times left to see Ari Shaffir. Jew, before it's over, all tickets at AriTheGreat.com. After Brea, I got my Texas run, and that'll be it for Texas. San Jose just added October 2nd at LOL. Dallas at the Addison Improv, October 3rd. Houston at their Improv, the 4th and the 5th. Then back to Dallas for a Cowboy game. Also October, I got Nashville, and that's it for October. And then the big show in Chicago at the Vic Theater on November 16th. I almost have a date for you guys for the special, for Ari Shaffir Drew. It's coming soon. It's not what I want to talk about right now. I want to read you this article. I was in Coupang. Took a flight there from... Mount Terry. There's a mountain. There's this volcanic Mount Mary. I'll tell you about this one because it's hard to get to. I will tell you guys about places I've been to when they are difficult to get to, but I will not ruin places that are undiscovered, that are easy to get to. I feel like I have a responsibility to keeping those things clean and great. So if you go to Labuan Bajo on the island of Flores in Indonesia, and by the way, this corruption shit is everywhere. Every Indonesian student learns the number of islands they have. I think it's like 17,146. I fucking shocked some guy on Lombok because he was teaching me how to surf. Mastered it in 2 days, so I don't surf anymore. And he goes, yeah, we have many islands here. That's a fucking terrible accent. What was that even? We have many islands here. It's definitely not Southeast Asian or Indonesian. And I was like, I hit him with the number, whatever the number is. And he was like, oh, well, how'd you know that? Because, you know, learn little pieces. And they teach every kid that in school. And then their president, because he was making fun of Trump a little bit. which I'm fine with, you know. But I was like, yeah, but what about Jacoby? And he was like, what you know about Jacoby? I'm like, I know he's a piece of shit who's crooked as fuck. And then the guy opened up and he was like, yeah, he sure is. And he told me he sold two islands to the Chinese. This president they have. They have this number of islands, 11,436, whatever it was. And now they have two less because this fucking crooked president decided to sell off two of the islands. Oh, to China. Yeah, that fucking corruption's everywhere. Anyway, took a plane from La Bombajo. That's where you go to see the Komodo dragons. You can take. We got on a boat. I gotta fucking edit this thing. The very final "This Is Not Happening" recording that I was a part of. This is a lot for an outro. I had just gotten home actually from this trip, from this Southeast Asian trip. I went straight. My first stop was to surprise my mom and dad, my family in D.C. And went, surprised them, spent a couple days there, then went straight from there to Nashville. I was nervous getting home, but whatever. Straight there to Nashville to the Wild West Comedy Festival. Jumped on there. I was able to communicate with my manager through mail, really, letters. I told her, if you still want to do that festival and do This Not Happening there, at Third Man Records, Jack White's record company, I was like, add it to their website and I will fucking get there. I was about ready to come home. I was about ready to come home. Not fully, but like, I didn't want to let her down. She was really looking forward to recording that. You know, her and Eric started that fucking show with me, and doing it at Third Man is like one of the cooler things. It's now called Ari Shaffir's Renamed Storytelling Show. But the last official thing under the name This Is Not Happening before shit hit the fan and a fucking same thing, power structure fucking pulled a power move and anyway, ruined something beautiful. By the way, Roy Wood is a friend who stepped up and saved people's jobs by taking over that show. He didn't fucking take it from under me. He called me and said, they're offering it to me. What should I do? And I said, it's the only way to save these people's jobs. You got to do it. So, and on short notice, he put together some stories in like a month. He's a hero. Anyway, it's ruined though. And the last official thing we did was recorded an album at Third Man Records that they still haven't put out. And I got to get them to fucking do it. And it was great. It was the last thing I hosted on with that name. This Is Not Happening. I did one more like unrecorded show like a little later in June at somewhere, the Bell House. That was great. But it was me, Ali Sadiq, Lisa Traeger, Kreischer. Me, Ali Sadiq, Lisa Traeger, Kreischer, Sean Patton. Is that it, or is there one more? And it was a great show. And we recorded it for a record, and we have got to get that shit and be able to fucking put it out. Anyway, I told this story about getting a boat, actually, from La Bombajo, the city in the, I guess, capital city of Flores. Nope. That is the end of it. it was a boat from Lombok to Flores. Yeah, I only told that story that time, and then like I tried three more times and it only worked that time. So yeah, I gotta put that fucking thing out because I ain't ever doing it again. It was also fresh. Anyway, back to La Bombajo. It's time to leave, and I'm like, I'm going to Mount Mary. I heard about a volcanic lake that has three different colors. There's three different little pools and there are different sediments come up and it's a three color lake. I took a picture of it. I put it on my Instagram. It would have been probably maybe in the year after, sometime in 2017. So I'll post it on the website on arishaffir.com. And you know what? I'll also post it when I post the fucking picture for this on on the Photoshop or the whatever fan makes that I pay $25 for, you guys, and I know that's not worth your time, but I pay the comics $100. So what am I going to do? Or the guests. I'm not going to, you know what I mean? If some comic comes on and gives me 2 hours of time and is hilarious and I give him $100, which I like doing, but like I can't pay a Photoshopper that same amount or like $300 or $400, whatever you guys deserve. So the people who do it out of the goodness of your heart, I use it. And I, if you make the one I use, I'll give you $25. That's the, but don't, if you don't have time, absolutely do not do it. It's only if you're bored and just want to put something together. It's only supposed to take you 20 minutes. Anyway, back to this. So I'm in Mount Mary. We finished. Me and this guy went down to, I forgot his name. I met him again in New York. I got to fucking find him again and see what he's doing. Some writer. And we took a car down to where the airport was. Got to the airport. You couldn't buy tickets. They wouldn't accept American. In Indonesia, it was a really tough time. They wouldn't accept American credit cards online. So we had to go to the airport to buy a ticket. I mean, this is fucking 1970s things or 80s things. Go to the airport. Like, I need one ticket to this. Can you even do that now? I need a ticket to San Francisco. Can you go down to LAX and say, I need a ticket to San Francisco? Remember Paul Ciancia, the guy who shot up all those TSA people? I want to interview him for my podcast. How do I get to him? By the way, I'm on Patreon right now in an effort to remove myself from the advertising model in general. It's patreon.com/skeptic tank. Go there. Every time I don't have a podcast on iTunes, I will do a solo podcast for Patreon. I'll also here or there upload podcast interviews early, so you know they won't have the intro and the outro on them, but if you just want to hear the interview, they'll be up there early for you, the Patreon fan subscriber. I think that might be the best model anyway. We'll see how it goes, but if I make enough in that, then I don't have to do advertisements for anything. Definitely no advertisements on that one, or no real ones. Anyway, back to this. So we and this dude, I forget his name, AJ maybe? Maybe AJ. You know, got a guy to take us down. Oh, we heard a crazy, oh my God, I'm having all these memories. I got to write this goddamn travel book. We had this guy take us down to the airport, got there, and it's closed. It's just closed. It's not the Mount Mary Airport. It's the one south of that. So what I was going to say is I'll post a picture when I post a picture on Instagram of the Photoshop. I always give credit to the guy too who makes it. I'll do a double photo. That's what I'll do. I'll do a double photo. So like when you see it, you can swipe to the next photo and that'll be the fucking volcano, volcanic lake. Okay. I'm almost done. Sorry, you guys. I'm getting to it. Anyway, waited at the airport for it to open. It was so fucking hot. We walked into town, got some warung food, which is just like food left out in a window. I mean, it's like kind of like pizza shops in New York where you can like the pizza's all out and you're like, I'll take a slice of pepperoni, and they take it and they put it back in the oven for like 2 minutes, heat it up, and then they give it to you, and now it's hot. It's reheated. It's not as good as fresh. That's why, by the way, my tip, always say, you got anything fresh coming out. Even if you had, if you're in the mood for pepperoni, a fresh not that is way better than anything. So if they're like, yeah, we got coming out in 2 minutes, wait for that one. If they're like, this one just came out, fucking get that one. Fresh slice is always the best. Even dollar pizza. You get a fresh slice of dollar, and it's still good. Anyway, but my ruling is, imagine when it's not fresh and they put it back in the oven. Still good if it's good, but they don't put it back in the oven. And instead of pizza, it's beef and chicken and occasionally dog and fish, rice. Ugh, that goddamn beef rendang. If you ever see that in Indonesia, that's just... Anyway, I'm lost. So we sat there in a... After we ate, we came back. The airport's still not open. We just sat in a fucking... Would have been a good place to do an interview, actually. We sat in a ATM booth that had air conditioning. It was it. And just sat there with our bags, with our giant backpacks. Mine is Osprey. they've always done me right, those Osprey bags. They lasted, and they're covered. I have one finally break a little like fastener, and I'm pretty sure they're going to replace that for free. But yeah, they've never done me wrong. They're not a sponsor, so I'm just telling you. Osprey bags. So anyway, we sat there and talked for a while until the airport opened up. Then I had to go pay in cash. He still wouldn't take my credit card. I had to go back to the ATM, take out cash to fly from there. Let me see where it was. Okay, I just found it. It was Kilimutu is the fucking volcanic lake. And Mount Kilimutu. And Mount Mary was where we flew from. So I went to Kupang and I was staying in this hostel. Oh, what a fucking fun hostel that was. And I met these two Argentinians. They actually kind of made it clear to me. We were talking about this magazine. They're like, what was it? And we started talking about revolution and shit. They said the most interesting thing about American politics is that we still had this almost like royal reverence for our leaders. Like we kind of view our president as like a king and we give him this respect. And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, well, we don't do that in Argentina. If our guy is a fuck up, we're just going to call him a fuck up to his face, you know? So, and I think that's maybe silver lining. If you got to look at the good of things, I think that might be a good thing about Trump is that we don't respect these guys anymore. You're just some dude who we elected to run shit. You're either going to do your job or we're going to fucking shit on you. We're not going to stop. We're not going to be like, no, you're great. We can't point out any of the bad stuff. We're going to point out the bad stuff for everyone that comes after this guy. Anyway, so I was waiting for my visa to Timor-Leste and talking to these Indonesians, and I read this article, and it's fucking great. It was in that November, December 2016 issue. It was called, what's the article called? My First Revolution by John Dennehy. I want to get him on my podcast. I'll read this and then I'll be done. 6 minutes. Buckle up and listen the whole way. Put your phones away, please. And listen. In April 2005, I was living in Cuenca, Ecuador, teaching English. I had just graduated college in the United States and was still very new to the place, but there was already a simmering fire about to explode. By the way, side note, and then I'll just read the whole thing all the way through, or try to. You can look up pictures of this, of everything I'm saying in here afterwards, and you'll see everything is true. But there was already a simmering fire about to explode. The president, who was hailed as a courageous defender of the nation's heritage and champion of the poor when elected, had quickly moved to the right as soon as the votes were counted. A few months previous to my own arrival, he had fired an unsympathetic court and replaced it with his friends. Latin America is not known for truthful or selfless leaders. So, taking a cue from their own recent history, people began to agitate for his removal. My new employer owned two schools, and every afternoon I walked half an hour through the city from one classroom to another. Every day I passed a large public university. One day, just 2 weeks or so into my daily walk, I noticed a small group of students with bandanas over their faces blocking traffic in front of the university. The next day, there were a few more of them, and some police milling 200 meters away. Walking by this small but growing blockade became a part of my daily routine, and some days after class, I would return and sit down on a curb to watch the scene unfold. Things began to heat up, and as the students with their bandanas grew in numbers, so did the group of police a couple hundred meters away. As the tension outside the university was growing, it was also increasing throughout the nation. Word soon spread that a general strike would begin on April 13th in the capital city of Quito, a few hundred miles north, as well as in Cuenca. Cuenca. That's the last I'll break in. Cuenca, Ecuador. These were the two largest and most important mountain cities in the Andean nation. My school, which was full of North Americans, posted alarmist advisories from the U.S. Embassy and warned us to keep a low profile. The Peace Corps readied their evacuation plans. Tanks began to appear in the streets. Everyone thought the country would explode. April 13th arrived and the streets were deserted. I walked around searching for the mass protest everyone was expecting. The park in the city center had become a major rallying point for the families and the less militant opposition in the previous days. A tank sat in the corner of the park and dozens of riot police stood around, but no one else was there. Nothing happened. The buses, which had joined the strike, began to run again around sundown, and it seemed the day would end in failure. I walked down to the university and found it much the same as it was the day before. Perhaps there were a few more people, but there was also a sense of desperation. A small group broke off and ran a few streets down to where the buses were beginning to run again. They stopped one, made everyone get off, and drove it to the barricade. The police had begun using a tank equipped with water cannon a few days earlier, putting out the fires and chasing down anyone they could. The bus added another layer to the barrier and would stop the tank. Within minutes, other groups were commandeering more buses and disabling them across intersections while screaming, "Viva el paro! Long live the strike!" The next day, things began to build quickly all over the city. Back at the university, I was struggling to speak to some of the students with my mostly non-existent Spanish when someone came over and began to translate for us. In the meantime, police had snuck up along some side streets and charged from the front with their tear gas rifles. The type of tear gas the police were using had been developed as a military weapon and was banned in my own home country. Once the gas hit you, it felt as if a sharp knife was being scraped against your eyeball, and you reflexively crunched your eyelids closed. After a few seconds, your body started to violently dry heave, as if your lungs were trying to jump right out of your chest. You got gassed once there and understood why everyone wore bandanas over their faces. I ran with my eyes closed and my lungs burning through clouds of gas and into the university. In Ecuador, police are banned from entering university grounds, which made it a safe zone and the most logical place to put up a blockade in front of. Happy to see some familiar faces in this place where mine didn't fit in, I found the group I had been conversing with when the gas chased us apart. I fell back onto some grass behind a small wall that we were standing in front of. A boy of no more than 13 or 14 years lit a cigarette, walked around the circle, and blew smoke into everyone's eyes to help take away the sting. As a water bottle was passed around to wash out our eyes and mouths, my new friend, Luis, explained to me what was happening. Earlier in the day, when a small group had started the blockade, some plainclothed police drove up in unmarked cars and chased them into the university, invading the sanctuary. Luis pointed a few feet away, past his cousin examining the welt on his stomach where one of the tear gas bullets struck, to some fresh bloodstains. We were standing in the same spot where police had caught some of the students that morning. Word of the beating spread quickly and brought out hundreds of people within a few hours. Meanwhile, police had taken back the parked buses, and retreated. Luis retied a white shirt over his face, and we walked back into the street. Others had already split off to get more buses. Luis picked up two fist-sized rocks as we joined the students who were already blocking the streets with their bodies where the bus had stood. With the road cleared, the tank began rumbling down towards us. Luis's eyes stared at me through the hole in his mask. He put one of the rocks in my hand and said, "Fight with us." As his eyes shifted back to the quickly approaching tank, by April 19th, the city was in open rebellion. Tear gas filled the air, but everyone knew who was winning. On the 20th, the protesters occupied every major government building and had effectively taken control of the city. The president fled, and we danced in the streets all night. We won. That was John Dennehy, My First Revolution. I don't know. It fucking got me, man. So when I got home, I made a list while I was traveling of some things I had to do when I got home. And some of them I've kept and some of them I have not. And I feel bad for the ones I have not. I have to go reread that list. Every time I got a thing of like, I've got to do this. One was spend more time with family. Lots of others. And one of them was subscribe to Adbusters. And it still took me a few months. And then finally I was like, hey, what am I doing? And then I went to the website and I did it. I subscribed. And I've been a subscriber since. I bought subscription from my friends. It's great. I would do it. But in the meantime, this Friday, September 13th, let a billion acts of civil disobedience rain down on the current world order. Join me, you guys. Do whatever you're going to do and join me. And then if it's not too illegal, or if you don't care, if you don't think they're looking at you, post about it. What was the hashtag they wanted? Anything goes. Maybe that one. Maybe a billion people. I don't know. Write about it. Tell your friends what you did. Get your friends to join in with you. Let's fuck it up, you guys. Let's fuck up the system a little bit. Let's make them hear us. Let's try a way, like where Callie says, where it's not violent. You know, where no one dies. And we still overthrow shit and we take the power back. I love all his ideas. I wish I could have talked to him longer. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the episode. That's it. Thank you very much for tuning in. I'm telling you, you start reading that magazine cover to cover like I do. And sometimes I fall back 3 episodes and then I start reading it and I'm finished in a day. It just changes the way you think. It gives you hope. It gives me hope. And it makes me also fucking riled up. Let's take it back. All right, you guys. Thank you very much for tuning in. Until next week, let your friends know about this podcast. Please try to spread it. Let it grow. So I can continue doing it and get more incentive to do it for more people. Thank you very much for tuning in. Have a good day, everybody. Till next week.
It's called Daisy. Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to. I'm a crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage, I can't afford a marriage. But you must see
important verse was the one they made up in Montgomery, Alabama. Said, we are not afraid. There's a lot of people in this world, they know what's right and what's wrong, but they're not gonna do anything about it. Somebody has to be willing to sing, we are not afraid.